Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt. Ready to get into the currents shaping things right now, financial, geopolitical, cultural.
And I'm Sam Astor. Yeah, today we're really digging into a snapshot of this moment. We're doing a deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Saturday, November 1st, 2025.
And we've got quite a stack here. Tech valuations, credit scores, even conflict zones like Sudan. A lot to unpack.
Exactly. Our job today is really to sift through all this, connect the dots for you, the listener, give you that full context.
Right. We want to zoom in on the details, the hidden links, and figure out what it actually means for your reality, especially financially. Mm-hmm. And maybe the best place to start is the markets. Because,
yeah.
I mean, despite all the economic uncertainty floating around, they seem to be on, a tear, like a rocket ship fueled by tech.
That's a perfect way to put it. The big headline, you really can't miss it. It's pretty historic, actually. The NASDAQ composite, it just finished its seventh straight month of gains.
Seventh month.
Yeah, seventh. That's the longest streak like that since 2018.
Yeah.
And if you think about the ups and downs we've seen recently, that kind of sustained momentum is, it's pretty extraordinary.
7 months straight, while, inflation's still sticky and consumers are apparently pulling back a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So what's driving this? What specific things are powering this this engine? Seems like it's ignoring the usual economic signs.
It really boils down almost entirely to two very concentrated things. First, you've got these really stellar earnings reports coming out of the big tech giants, consistently beating expectations.
Okay.
And second, the market is just completely obsessed with AI. It's rewarding this huge flurry of deals all centered around this race for, AI dominance. The growth isn't broad-based. It's really localized right there in big tech.
Localized is definitely the word. Because the milestones we're talking about they're redefining market gravity. The Magnificent Seven, right? Oh. That group of huge stocks driving it all.
Mm.
NVIDIA, for instance, king of AI chips. It's now the world's first $5 trillion company.
$5 trillion. Yeah. Just to put that in perspective for you, the entire GDP of Germany, a major economy, is only a little bit bigger than NVIDIA's market cap right now.
Wow.
And it's not just NVIDIA. Apple and Microsoft, they both topped $4 trillion in market cap just this past week.
That concentration is, it's really something. The whole group, Alphabet, Amazon, Meta, Tesla, plus those top three, their combined climb, pushed the NASDAQ up. What was it, 4.7% just in October?
That's right. And Amazon specifically, wow, it had a huge day Friday, surged 9.6%, hit a new all-time high, puts its market cap at $2.61 trillion.
And what drove that specifically for Amazon?
Directly linked to AI again. They reported faster than expected growth in AI-related revenue. And crucially, they announced really aggressive plans to expand their data centers to meet all that soaring demand.
So it really seems like investors just see any spending on AI as like an immediate guaranteed future return. Doesn't matter how much they're spending.
Pretty much seems that way.
But let's pause on that concentration point. The Magnificent Seven now make up, 38% of the entire S&P 500's value. I mean, doesn't that kind of concentration just, blow up the whole idea of a diversified market? Doesn't it introduce some serious systemic risk?
Oh, it absolutely does. And that's where you see this market excitement hitting a structural wall. The market's basically become a game of seven giant players. The performance of the whole index, it really hangs almost entirely on whether they keep succeeding.
A winner-take-all situation.
Exactly. It's very specific where the gains are happening. Now, this rally did help stocks hit record highs again after that. Remember the April tariff-fueled market meltdown.
Right, when the U.S. put those big duties on Chinese goods and the market tanked for a bit.
Yeah. So the tech rebound basically erased all that pain. But the risk is still there. If just one or two of these giants stumble, they could drag the whole S&P 500 down way out of proportion.
But investors seem willing to take that risk because the returns are just, too good right now.
Seems that way. And it's not just the NASDAQ. The Dow Jones, the more traditional index, it's also riding high. It's on a six-month winning streak, which is its longest in 7 years.
And the number of record closes tells a story too, right?
It really does. Paints a clear picture of this very focused prosperity. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500, they've each hit 36 record closes this year alone. The Dow, 15. It clearly shows the wealth generation is happening in tech, specifically around AI investment.
Okay, so that leads us straight into this this paradox, the AI spending paradox, as the journal calls it, the sheer amount of money needed to keep this boom going.
Yeah, that paradox is the multi-hundred-billion-dollar question hanging over everything. Silicon Valley's biggest players, they're planning to pour something like $400 billion into AI just this year.
400 billion.
In 1 year.
Right. But, and here's the kicker, the consensus from basically all of them, Microsoft, Amazon, Meta, Google, is that $400 billion is nowhere near enough. That's an incredible amount of money, and they still feel short. What are the actual constraints? What's the bottleneck that even $400 billion can't fix right now?
It's specialized computing power, mostly GPUs, those graphics processing units, mainly from NVIDIA, right? And also the massive data centers you need to house them. Microsoft, for example, they basically admitted on their earnings call they're short on computing power.
Microsoft is short.
Yeah. And they expect that shortage to last through at least the first half of next year.
If Microsoft, with all its cash, is short on computing power, the demand must be absolutely insane. How does that affect their business then?
Well, their cloud business, Azure, feels it. They literally can't supply the GPU capacity fast enough for customers who are desperate to run their own AI models. Amazon's in the same boat, racing to get cloud capacity online because they're making money off it the second it's available. Huge demand for data center services.
Okay, so that's the immediate need. But then you look at Meta, Facebook's parent company. They seem to be taking a much more aggressive, maybe even speculative, long-term view, even if it hurts their main business now.
That's right. Meta expects its capital spending, which is already almost double last year at $72 billion this year, to get notably larger in 2026. Mark Zuckerberg is basically aggressively front-loading this huge capacity build.
And the goal there is what? Artificial general intelligence, AGI.
Exactly. That's the moonshot. True machine intelligence, surpassing human ability across the board. Still very much a future goal, maybe speculative.
Right. But that speculation has a real cost today, doesn't it?
It does. Meta's incredibly profitable ads business. It's actually running in what they call a compute-starved state right now.
Compute starved. What does that mean
Don't like
practically?
that. It means the computing resources that would normally be optimizing their ad targeting, making that business even more profitable now, are being diverted to train these enormous future-focused AGI models. It's a very deliberate strategic sacrifice of current profit for potential future dominance.
Wow. If management is willing to run its cash cow in a, quote, compute-starved state, doesn't that sort of undermine its massive valuation right now? Are investors just ignoring that risk, or do they really believe winning the AGI race is worth basically anything?
That is the absolute core tension the market is wrestling with. And you saw it in the investor reaction this week. It was split based on how quickly they think the company can make money off this AI stuff.
How so?
Well, Google and Amazon, they seem to be monetizing AI almost instantly through cloud demand, right? So they got the blessings, as one report put it. Their stocks jumped Google up about 6%, Amazon nearly 10%. But Meta and Microsoft, once talking about capacity constraints and huge upfront speculative spending, they saw drops. Meta closed down 11%, Microsoft fell nearly 3%.
So the big question everyone's asking is this spending absolutely necessary to compete for AGI, or are we just inflating a massive AI bubble?
Exactly. The anxiety is, you can almost feel it. One analyst actually asked Microsoft straight up if we were in a bubble. The biggest fear seems to be FOMO, fear of missing out.
Right.
As another analyst said, the greatest risk is perceived as to underspend and to be left with a competitive disadvantage if AGI really does arrive and arrives quickly.
So they're betting the farm on it. What happens if they're wrong about the spending needed?
Well, Zuckerberg's comment was basically, if they overspend, they'll just slow building new infrastructure for some period while we grow into what we build. But nobody wants to be the company that sat on the sidelines and missed the AGI revolution because they were too cautious with spending.
Okay, let's dig a bit deeper here, because while all this attention, all these billions, are focused on these huge, large language models, the LLMs aiming for AGI, the journal points to something else, a kind of hidden engine of AI that's actually doing a lot of the practical, cost-effective work right now.
Yeah, this is maybe one of the most important nuances in the whole AI story. The big fancy LLMs get the headlines and the massive investment, right? But it's the small language models, the SLMs, that are quietly transforming how work gets done.
SLMs, small language models. How are they different?
They're smaller, naturally faster, much cheaper to run, and they're specialized for narrower, often repetitive tasks, not trying to be everything to everyone like the LLMs.
The cost difference is significant.
Oh, huge. Look at OpenAI's models. Their cheapest one, GPT-5 Nano, costs about 10 cents per million tokens processed. The big, sophisticated GPT-5, that's around 3.44 per million tokens.
Wow, that's more than 30 times cheaper for the SLM, plus the big ones probably use way more tokens to think.
Exactly. And that massive cost difference is driving companies to use what the journal calls the AI knowledge factory model. It's basically an assembly line approach.
An assembly line. How does that work with AI?
Companies are building software workflows where these cheaper, simpler SLMs act like specialized workers. They handle, say, 80% of the repetitive stuff cheaply and quickly along this virtual conveyor belt.
So instead of giving one super expensive AI brain the whole job, they're breaking it down,
yeah,
delegating based on complexity and cost.
Precisely. Take a company like Gong. They do conversational AI for big clients like Google and Cisco. If a customer asks a really complex question like, why are my sales falling? Gong doesn't just throw it straight to the expensive GPT-5.
Okay, so what do they do first?
They might send the question to an expensive LLM, but only to ask for a broad plan or a framework for how to answer it, like step one, step two, step three. Then, once they have that plan, the cheaper SLMs kick in. Maybe one SLM sifts through thousands of sales call transcripts looking for trends. Another SLM summarizes those calls. A third one scans the summaries for keywords or sentiment. Only after all that pre-processing by the cheap SLMs is done, then they hand all that digested information back to the expensive LLM, which pulls it all together into the final actionable report for the customer.
That's incredibly smart. You use the cheap models for the heavy lifting, the data crunching, and reserve the expensive thinking power for the final synthesis.
Exactly. Airbnb is doing similar things, using AI, including some open source models from Alibaba, apparently, to handle a lot of customer service issues automatically, faster than humans could. Even Meta, despite its huge AGI ambitions, relies heavily on small models for things like serving personalized ads. Why? Because the biggest models are just too cost prohibitive for that kind of high volume immediate return task.
So it seems like the real immediate impact of AI on business, on competitiveness, maybe even jobs, isn't coming from some single mega brain. Mm. It's coming from clever engineers stitching together these smaller, cheaper AIs into really effective workflows. It's the architecture, the process design that's making the difference right now.
Yeah, and researchers from NVIDIA and Georgia Tech basically confirmed that. They said small models are sufficiently powerful, inherently more suitable, and necessarily more economical for the specialized, repetitive jobs. The efficiency gains from SLMs are probably a big part of why we're seeing those stellar tech earnings we talked about.
Right.
Which creates this weird split, doesn't it? Big tech is booming partly because of these operational efficiencies, even while they're spending like crazy on speculative AGI.
That is a great transition point.
Yeah.
Because you've got this intense, almost manic growth in efficiency in tech, but we need that reality check now. Let's connect that market excitement with the signals from the broader economy, because the data there suggests a very, very different picture for, you know, Main Street.
Oh, yeah. The broader signals are definitely flashing caution. Take consumer spending. Chipotle. They issued a warning this week, seeing lower demand, especially from younger folks and lower income consumers.
Chipotle is interesting. Kind of an affordable treat or staple for many.
Right. And households earning less than $100,000 a year make up something like 40% of their sales. So if they're pulling back at Chipotle, it suggests real financial stress for a big chunk of the population. They're cutting back even on small discretionary things.
That points to pressure from inflation, maybe economic uncertainty.
And then look at the labor market. While big tech is pouring billions into AI infrastructure, these same companies are cutting jobs. Amazon just announced thousands of layoffs, part of a bigger plan to cut maybe up to 30,000 jobs.
30,000.
Up to, yeah. And Meta recently cut 600 jobs, even in its AI division. Plus, you've seen cuts announced by UPS, Target, GM.
It's a strange contrast, isn't it? Massive investment in automation and efficiency coupled with shedding workers.
Yeah.
The market loves the earnings growth, but that growth clearly isn't translating into broad job security. It just further concentrates the economic benefits.
Mm-hmm. And then you've got regional business data. The Chicago Business Barometer, it ticked up slightly in October, which is, you know, better than falling. But it's still at 43.8. Anything below 50 means contraction, not expansion. So we're still looking at continued slow growth, regionally at least.
And the housing market, that ultimate bedrock of American wealth.
Still frozen solid, absolutely frozen. The U.S. home turnover rate, it's at 2.8%. That's the lowest it's been in at least 30 years.
Wow. Why so low?
It's this golden handcuffs thing people talk about. If you bought or refinanced when rates were super low, you don't want to sell and give up that cheap mortgage. Plus, for new buyers, current high rates and general economic uncertainty make it really tough. Affordability is a huge issue. Sales are down almost 40% compared to the pandemic buying boom.
Okay, so consumers are stressed, job cuts are happening, housing is stuck. What about the Fed? They just cut rates, but apparently there was some disagreement.
Yeah, the Fed cut rates by a quarter point, but it wasn't unanimous. And the dissent is really interesting. It highlights these financial tensions. Jeffrey Schmid, the Kansas City Fed president, he voted against the cut.
Why? What's his argument?
Basically, that inflation has been above their 2% target for over 4 years now. And he doesn't see much evidence that the current interest rates are actually restrictive enough to bring it down.
Not restrictive enough, even with rates where they are. Why does he think that?
He points to things like the surge in business investment we're seeing, especially in tech. He points to the soaring stock prices we just discussed. And he notes that corporate borrowing conditions are still relatively easy.
Wow.
So his argument is these things suggest maybe current rates aren't really leaning against economic growth and inflation as much as they should be. If companies can still borrow easily despite high Fed rates, maybe the market's optimism is kind of overriding the Fed's policy signals.
So he's suggesting the high stock prices aren't just a sign of wealth, but might actually be working against the Fed's goal by keeping money flowing easily in the corporate world.
That seems to be his concern. He admits the job market has weakened, but he also questions whether lower interest rates can even fix that if the job losses are due to structural changes like, you know, AI-driven automation and layoffs. Maybe rate cuts won't bring those jobs back anyway.
That's a really complex picture. High-flying tech, struggling consumers, and disagreement within the Fed itself about how tight policy really is.
It sums up the tension perfectly.
Okay, so we've got this uneven financial foundation, heavily reliant on a few tech giants. Let's pivot now sharply to Washington and geopolitics. Because there, the basic stability of the government itself seems to be hanging by a thread. There was a government shutdown crisis, right? And it was threatening something really fundamental, food aid.
Yeah, the shutdown hit a really critical point concerning SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, food stamps, basically. Payments for about 42 million Americans, mostly poor, elderly, disabled folks, they were set to just stop. The funding for the new fiscal year hadn't been approved.
42 million people. That's a potential humanitarian crisis on a huge scale. How much does SNAP cost usually?
About $8 billion a month. The Trump administration first kind of hinted they'd use emergency funds, but then they claimed those funds weren't legally available to cover the full November benefits.
Which sounds like a legal maneuver. Did it get challenged?
Immediately. And crucially, two federal judges stepped in. Judge McConnell in Rhode Island and Judge Talwani in Massachusetts both ordered the administration to use those emergency contingency funds and keep paying the benefits. Judge Talwani was pretty scathing, actually, calling the administration's attempt to stop payments likely unlawful.
Okay, so the judges provided a temporary fix. But that put President Trump in a tricky spot, right? He had to agree to keep the benefits flowing somehow, but he didn't want to give ground in the actual shutdown negotiations in the Senate.
Exactly. And the political fight over the shutdown itself really zeroed in on the Senate filibuster rule. President Trump was demanding that GOP senators just bypass the Democrats entirely to reopen the government. And to do that, they'd have to get rid of the filibuster, which usually requires 60 votes to get anything done.
That demand must have really thrown a wrench into things. Weren't senators actually making some progress on a bipartisan deal?
They were. For months, senators had been in these delicate talks. Democrats, led by Chuck Schumer, were insisting on extending those enhanced Obamacare subsidies before they'd provide the votes the GOP needed to reopen the government. The filibuster was basically their main leverage point.
It's kind of ironic, isn't it? Democrats often criticize the filibuster. Didn't Hakeem Jeffries call it a Jim Crow relic?
He did. That term refers to how it was historically used to block civil rights laws. But now, with Republicans in charge, Democrats were using that same rule to block the GOP agenda. Politics makes strange bedfellows, right?
Or maybe just predictable ones. Mm-hmm. So Jeffries deferred to the Senate on changing the rule.
Yeah. And while most Republicans still wanted to keep the filibuster, the pressure from the White House to just scrap it and pass a spending bill was intense. Really highlights the deep gridlock.
Okay, shifting from domestic gridlock to international trade. There was a resolution involving a Dutch semiconductor company, Nexperia. Seems small but important.
Yes, Nexperia. They make chips that are absolutely crucial for making cars globally. Their shipments got halted when the Dutch government seized control of the company from its Chinese owner. That threatened to really mess up car production worldwide.
And it shows how tangled supply chains are, right? They process most of their stuff in China.
Yeah, 70 to 80%. Shows just how interconnected things are.
So how did they resolve it, despite all the tough trade talk?
Well, apparently Nexperia is going to resume shipments. It came out of a framework agreement reached in those recent talks between President Trump and China's Xi Jinping.
Interesting. So even with all the rivalry, when something core like the global auto supply chain is at risk, they find a way to make a practical deal.
Seems like it. Sometimes pragmatism has to win out, at least temporarily.
Okay, let's move to another kind of battle. An internal power struggle that actually affects almost every American's financial life. The FICO score war. This sounds intense.
Oh, it is. It's basically a fight over who gets to decide if you're creditworthy. Who controls that magic number that dictates whether you get a loan, a mortgage, even a phone plan sometimes.
And who are the players in this war?
It's mainly Fair Isaac. The company that created the FICO score, FICO stands for Fair Isaac Corporation, pitted against the three big credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion.
Right. The bureaus collect the data.
Exactly. But they're tired of FICO having this near monopoly on the score itself. So the bureaus are pushing their own alternative score, called Vantage Score, really hard.
FICO's been dominant for decades, though, right?
Yeah.
Using like 90% of lending decisions.
Yeah, totally dominant. But the current FICO CEO, Will Lansing, realized something. They'd been seriously underpricing their main product, the mortgage score, for years, decades even.
Undervalued it.
Massively. So his big strategy, which was really successful financially but super controversial, was to just hike the prices dramatically. The price for a mortgage score hit $4.95 in 2025, and it's set to double again to $10 next year.
$10 per score?
Yeah.
From just pennies before?
Yeah. FICO execs basically felt the old price was way too low. One of them apparently called the old approach the Lord's work mentality, suggesting they used to care more about serving the industry than making maximum profit.
And those price hikes, big impact on FICO's bottom line.
Huge. Their revenue from selling scores shot up to $920 million in fiscal 2024. That's nearly five times what it was just a decade ago. Made Lansing one of the highest paid CEOs in the S&P 500. But naturally, it also brought down some serious heat from the government.
Right. From the FHFA head, Bill Pulte. Remind us, what's the FHFA and why is Pulte so powerful here?
FHFA is the Federal Housing Finance Agency. They regulate Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the government-backed giants that guarantee most U.S. mortgages. Because FHFA dictates which credit scores Fannie and Freddie can use, Pulte's decisions have enormous immediate market power.
And Pulte, appointed by Trump, didn't hold back, did he? Used social media.
Yeah, he went after FICO pretty hard on X, calling them a monopoly, accusing them of trying to threaten regulators.
Yeah.
Then he really shook things up. He gave Fannie and Freddie the green light to start using VantageScore for a lot of mortgage approvals.
His goal being what? More competition, lower costs.
Exactly. Inject competition, bring down the cost of scores for lenders and ultimately consumers, and hopefully open up homeownership to more people.
But FICO pushed back, right? Lansing argued that letting lenders choose scores could lead to a race to the bottom, picking the score that makes borrowers look best, not necessarily the most accurate.
Right. He warned it could dilute credit standards and hurt the mortgage industry and maybe taxpayers down the line if things go sour.
So what was FICO's countermove against the credit bureaus pushing VantageScore?
It was pretty dramatic. They basically announced a plan to cut the credit bureaus out of the loop, at least for some scores. They want to let other companies, called tri-merge resellers, calculate FICO scores directly using FICO's own model.
Tri-merge resellers, who are they?
They're companies already in the mortgage ecosystem. They basically gather your credit reports from all three bureaus, Equifax, Experian, TransUnion, and package them together for the lender.
So FICO wants to work directly with them, bypassing the big three bureaus.
Exactly. FICO plans to charge these resellers less, $4.95 per score, plus maybe a fee if the loan actually closes. That undercuts what the bureaus currently charge FICO for integrating the score with the data.
Wow. So FICO is basically using pricing as a weapon to punish the bureaus for promoting VantageScore.
That's exactly what it looks like. And the market reacted instantly. The credit bureaus' stock prices sank while FICO surged. It's a really high-stakes, complex fight over who controls probably the most fundamental measure of financial trust in America.
Yeah, the value of that information, the value of perceived reliability, it's being fought over tooth and nail.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's shift from credit scores to space security. The growing role of SpaceX in national security projects, particularly President Trump's Golden Dome missile defense idea, and the fears it's stirring up about relying too much on one company.
Right. SpaceX is apparently set to get a huge contract, around $2 billion, to develop satellites for this Golden Dome project. It's meant to be a system for tracking missiles and aircraft, could involve up to 600 satellites eventually in low Earth orbit.
And SpaceX clearly has the edge technologically here, right? Mm. They can build and launch satellites way faster than the traditional defense companies like Lockheed Martin.
That's the key advantage, especially since Trump wants the system up and running relatively quickly. SpaceX's speed gives them a huge leg up.
But that speed comes with concerns, this idea of vendor lock.
Yeah, serious concerns among military leaders, lawmakers like Senator Rick Scott, too. Vendor lock just means the U.S. could become totally dependent on SpaceX for this critical infrastructure. That could stifle competition down the road, maybe let SpaceX jack up prices later. The Defense Science Board warned about this last year. Vendor lock can kill innovation.
And the worry isn't just theoretical, is it? Given Elon Musk's, let's say, unpredictable leadership style.
Exactly. Government officials point to things Musk has done in the past, like threatening to decommission a NASA spacecraft that takes astronauts to the space station. That kind of thing makes them nervous about relying on him for critical national security. What if he decides to unilaterally change the terms or just pull the plug? The U.S. might not have an immediate backup.
And SpaceX is involved in other Pentagon satellite networks, too.
Yeah, they're expected to be major players in MILNET for sensitive military communications and another system for tracking vehicles on the ground. Their influence in U.S. national security is definitely growing fast, forcing the Pentagon into this tricky balancing act. Weigh the risk of dependency against the need for rapid tech advancement.
Okay, let's move to some global hotspots now. The Journal has some really stark updates from Sudan and Venezuela. Let's start with Sudan. The civil war in Darfur seems to have escalated horribly, comparisons to genocide.
It's catastrophic. The reporting focuses on the Arab-led militia, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. They're apparently using advanced military drones, specifically Chinese-made Wing-Lung Seti and Feihong 95 models, to just brutalize the local non-Arab black population.
Chinese drones? How did the RSF get those?
Intelligence reports suggest they were supplied by the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, which turns this into more of a proxy war situation. The reports detail RSF fighters going door-to-door, targeting non-Arab men and boys for execution, systematic rape of black women. The ethnic hatred driving it is described as extreme.
And that's leading to these grim comparisons.
Yeah. Human rights groups, researchers, they're explicitly comparing it to the Rwandan genocide in 1994. One researcher said the level of ethnic hatred from the RSF is equal to that of the Hutus toward the Tutsis in Rwanda.
That's chilling.
And tragically, they warn that the total death toll, when you factor in famine, disease, exposure caused by the conflict, might actually end up surpassing Rwanda's.
This conflict started how? A power struggle.
Yeah, about 2 years ago between two rival generals, both ethnically Arab, Lt. Gen Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the army chief, and the RSF leader, Lt. Gen Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. It's threatening to just tear the country apart. But this proxy element, the UAE allegedly backing the RSF with these high-tech Chinese drones, why? What's the UAE's angle?
Good question. What's the strategic play there?
Well, the RSF controls large parts of Sudan, including areas with valuable gold mines, and potentially access to ports on the Red Sea, which is a super important global shipping route. So the thinking is, by backing the RSF, the UAE is trying to secure long-term influence over those economic and strategic assets. It makes the conflict look less like just an internal fight and more like a regional power play, fueled by advanced weapons sourced internationally.
And the use of Chinese drones, even if supplied by someone else, just highlights how technology is changing modern warfare, right? Giving sophisticated tools to militias and factions.
Absolutely. Meanwhile, shifting continents to South America, Chevron is in a really awkward spot in Venezuela.
Right. They've been there forever, over a century. And they just got a new license to keep drilling, but they have to share about half the oil they produce with Nicolas Maduro's regime.
Exactly. Which puts them directly at odds with Washington's whole maximum pressure campaign against Maduro. The Trump administration has built up the biggest U.S. military presence in the Caribbean since the 80s aircraft carriers like the USS Gerald R. Ford, B-52 bombers flying overhead specifically to lean on Maduro, and Chevron's oil tankers are sailing right through those same waters.
What's Chevron's justification for staying then? Their CEO, Mike Wirth, made an argument to U.S. officials, didn't he?
Yeah, his argument was basically, if Chevron leaves, who fills the vacuum? China. China is already the biggest buyer of Venezuelan oil. Wirth argued that pulling out would just hand Venezuela's oil wealth completely over to China and permanently reduce American influence there.
But critics say Chevron staying actually helps Maduro, gives his regime a lifeline, politically and financially.
That's the counterargument. Even though Chevron is there, supposedly maintaining U.S. influence, a lot of Venezuela's share of that oil apparently ends up going to China anyway, through black markets, often at big discounts, and that money helps keep Maduro's regime afloat.
So it's kind of a lose-lose for U.S. policy. Stay and prop up Maduro, or leave and let China take over completely.
Seems like a classic example of the really difficult choices you face when operating in an authoritarian country that's directly in Washington's bad books.
Okay, let's move into some of the social, political, and cultural deep dives now, starting with a big move from the British monarchy. Prince Andrew has been, well, definitively demoted.
Yeah. King Charles finally took decisive action. Seems he recognized that the whole long-running scandal around Andrew's ties to Jeffrey Epstein was just casting too long a shadow, threatening his own reign and Prince William's future reign, too.
And the outcome is pretty final.
Looks like it. Andrew's been formally stripped of his royal status, his royal residence. He's now just Mr. Mountbatten Windsor. He loses the big mansion he lived in rent-free. Charles is apparently going to personally pay for him to live in a much smaller house on the Sandringham estate, the family's sort of holiday place.
It's more than just symbolic, then. It's a complete removal from public life as a royal. What finally pushed Charles to act now? What were the immediate triggers?
Two big things happened recently that seemed to have forced his hand. First, Andrew's main accuser, Virginia Jufer, sadly died earlier this year. And her memoir was just published posthumously. It detailed her allegations, including a really controversial story involving Andrew. Public reaction was intense.
Right. And the second thing?
The British press got hold of emails showing Andrew was still communicating with Epstein back in 2011. That was after Andrew claimed, in that disastrous BBC interview back in 2019, that he'd cut all ties. So the emails directly contradicted his own story.
Made his position completely untenable. Seems like Charles is really focused on cleaning house, making sure the monarchy is stable for William. Reportedly, William was pushing for this too.
Yeah, reports suggest William wanted decisive action to restore public trust. Royal experts say this is about the strongest move the monarchy could make, short of, you know, legal action. Apparently, Queen Elizabeth had been reluctant to fully sideline Andrew because he was said to be her favorite son. But once Charles took the throne, the priority clearly shifted to protecting the institution itself.
Okay. From removing royal figures to removing actual royal treasures. Let's talk about that wild $102 million jewelry heist at the Louvre. Sounds like a movie, but apparently it was pretty low-tech.
The audacity definitely drew comparisons to Ocean's 11. Getting into one of the most famous, supposedly secure museums in the world and walking out with French crown jewels, Napoleon's necklace for his wife, Empress Eugenie's diamond crown, incredible stuff.
But the execution was what? Slapdash? How did they actually pull off the break-in?
Pretty basic tools, actually, combined with finding a key security blind spot. They used a stolen truck that had one of those hydraulic lifts on it, parked it outside a balcony of the Louvre Palace. They even wore yellow vests like maintenance workers. Then just angle grinders to cut through the bullet-resistant display cases. Relied on city noise and the early hour to cover the sound.
So the planning was in finding the weak spot, but the method was crude. And they got caught because of a basic mistake.
Pure panic and human error. The team, apparently four guys, made a huge blunder during the escape. They'd brought gasoline with them, planning to torch the truck and equipment to destroy all the evidence.
Standard procedure for pros, right?
You'd think. But security forces closed in way faster than they expected. They panicked, abandoned the plan to burn the evidence, and just bolted on scooters, leaving the gasoline-soaked truck right there.
And that truck, unburned, was basically a forensic treasure trove for the police.
Absolutely. Paris prosecutors recovered over 150 DNA samples, fingerprints, other bits of evidence from the truck in the scene, a dropped glove, even a piece of the damaged crown. This mountain of evidence led them straight to three suspects within days, including one guy trying to skip the country. That moment of panic, failing to destroy the evidence, that was the $102 million mistake that caught them. The jewels are still missing, though.
Low-tech crime, high-tech forensics, undone by nerves. Okay, now let's look at how technology, specifically AI, is causing chaos in politics. That NYC mayoral race.
Yeah, we're seeing AI deepfakes become cheap, easy political weapons now. The big example is that video attacking the Democratic Socialist candidate, Zoran Mamdani, called Commie Town.
Then the guy who made it, wasn't he involved in that college admissions scandal?
Greg Abbott, yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the felons from the Varsity Blues scandal back in 2019. He paid a digital studio less than $5,000 to create this attack video.
Less than $5,000. What did the video show?
It was a deepfake of Mamdani sort of dancing while the city burned around him, set to a rewritten Frank Sinatra song, lyrics like, "Imagine North Korea with a dash of Sharia, that's what you got, New York, New York." And it used really racially charged images threatening Arab men, a black man with a machete on the subway. Pretty nasty stuff.
YouTube took it down eventually.
They did, but apparently only after the Sinatra estate complained about the song copyright. Which is interesting, right? It got pulled for IP infringement, not necessarily because it was racist, deepfake political propaganda. Highlights a real gray area in the law right now.
And this deepfake stuff reflects how polarized that NYC race is.
Totally. Mamdani's platform rent freezes, tax hikes on the rich, free childcare. It's really spooked the business community and more moderate Democrats.
Like Tom Suozzi, the Democratic congressman who endorsed Mamdani's rival, Andrew Cuomo.
Exactly. Suozzi basically argued that Mamdani's socialist policies would just accelerate the exodus of people, businesses, and political clout from New York City. He pointed out New York's already huge tax burden is driving wealthy residents away.
So these deepfakes are just pouring fuel on that fire. What's the effect on voters, do you think?
It seems to be making people question everything they see. As one expert put it, when voters assume that everything is fake, there will be an even higher premium on authenticity for political candidates. Trust becomes even more valuable when deception is so easy and cheap.
Speaking of authenticity and, well, baggage, let's look at that Senate primary in Maine. The Iraq veteran Graham Platner challenging the incumbent governor, Janet Mills. It seems to be testing how much personal history progressives are willing to overlook.
Yeah. Platner raised a lot of money fast, over $3 million. Progressives were really excited about him, seen as this authentic working-class guy challenging the older, more centrist Mills. His campaign hit hard on populist themes, going after billionaires and corrupt politicians.
But then came the revelations. The tattoo.
Right. An apparent Nazi symbol, the Totenkopf, the skull and crossbones used by the SS tattooed on his chest, that caused a huge uproar.
Governor Mills didn't mince words about it.
No, she was blunt. Said, it is not neo-Nazi, it is Nazi. The symbol that SS soldiers wore as they murdered 6 million Jewish people. Platner apologized, got it covered up, said it was from years ago when he had severe PTSD after his tours in Iraq and Afghanistan.
But that wasn't the only issue, was it? Past online comments.
No. He also had to apologize for a bunch of old comments found on places like Reddit. Anti-gay slurs, stuff disparaging police, rural white people, comments that seemed to downplay sexual assault, which he blamed on the crude humor of the infantry back then.
So the core question for Democrats becomes,
are they willing to accept all that baggage to get a young, fiery progressive who might actually connect with working class voters the party's been losing? It's a real test of whether they're ready to ditch the older centrists like Mills, even if the alternative comes with significant flaws. Some staff quit, but his big endorser, Bernie Sanders, hasn't bailed, and apparently people are still showing up for Platner's events.
Maine usually elects moderates, though. This stuff has to hurt his chances in a general election, even if he wins the primary, right? Forces voters to weigh ideological purity against, well, basic political viability and standards.
Definitely complicates his path.
Okay, let's give it again. To the financial reckoning happening at a really elite university, the University of Chicago. It's a case study in how the relentless pursuit of prestige through spending can backfire.
Yeah, UChicago, famous for all its Nobel laureates, is facing a serious financial crisis. They ran budget deficits for 14 years straight, Why? A massive spending spree to boost its ranking and reputation, compete head-on with the Ivies.
And the strategy worked in terms of prestige.
Oh, yeah. They poured money into fancy new labs, dorms, tech. Undergraduate enrollment went way up. Their yield rate, the percentage of accepted students who actually enroll, shot up to 88%, one of the highest anywhere. Acceptance rate dropped below 5%. They successfully made themselves the hot, elite school.
But that growth was fueled by debt. A lot of debt.
A crippling amount. Through much of the 2010s, they were issuing hundreds of millions in bonds every year, sometimes using more expensive types of debt that could cover operating costs, not just buildings. Now, they owe about $4.5
billion. $4.5
billion. Yeah, which is as much debt as places like Princeton or Yale. But UChicago has less than half their endowment size, fewer liquid assets. The debt burden is way heavier relative to their resources.
And now the Piper needs paying, forcing cuts. Painful ones.
Extremely painful. They have to close a $288 million budget gap. So they're slowing down, hiring for tenure track faculty, scaling back construction projects. And this is the really controversial part, pausing PhD admissions entirely in almost 20 programs for a year.
Which programs got hit hardest? And what does that say about how universities value different fields when push comes to shove?
The humanities are bearing the brunt. Classics, English, linguistics, a bunch of others are pausing PhD admissions. It forces the university to really confront its core values. It suggests that when a financial crisis hits, the program seen as generating less direct revenue or maybe less measurable prestige, unlike, say, hard sciences or professional schools, they're the first on the chopping block.
Faculty must be worried about the long-term damage. Well, good students just write off UChicago now.
Mm-hmm.
Can a PhD program even function if it gets too small? Makes you wonder what the point of doctoral education is seen to be, creating knowledge or just feeding an academic job market that's shrinking anyway because of these cuts.
Exactly. The provost, Catherine Baker, defended the past spending, saying it boosted academic eminence and the debt is manageable. But that $4.5 billion debt isn't going away. The payments on the principal alone are set to more than double by 2029. So the financial strain is baked in for years, no matter what they do now.
Okay, from the crisis in academic value, let's look at another measure of value art. Specifically, the auction of Maurizio Cattelan's solid gold working toilet, titled America.
This is just a fascinating, very literal test of the art market's appetite for, well, gilded absurdity and its ability to assign value beyond the material. The toilet itself is made of 223 pounds of 18-karat gold. The gold alone is worth around $10 million.
And Sotheby's is starting the bidding there,
right,
at $10 million.
Yep. They're betting its conceptual value as art will push the price much higher than just the metal value. Remember Catalin's last big stunt? The banana duct tape to a wall comedian sold for $6.2 million before someone ate it.
Right. It's the ultimate statement on sacred versus profane, isn't it? Questioning what we value, what spaces are special.
That was Catalin's intent. The piece has a bit of a history, too. The first version was installed in a bathroom at the Guggenheim in New York back in 2016. People lined up 100,000 of them to see it, and yes, to use it. That was a huge success.
But then another version got stolen.
Infamously. A second version was installed at Blenheim Palace in the UK in 2019. Thieves broke in with sledgehammers and stole it. It's never been found. Police assume it was melted down immediately for the gold.
So, given the Louvre heist we just talked about, security for this auction must be intense.
Off the charts, presumably. Sotheby's says security is heavily bolstered. And here's a detail that speaks volumes about the art experience. Potential bidders can view the toilet. It'll be installed in a bathroom at Sotheby's in Manhattan, but they are explicitly told they cannot use it.
Cannot use the functional toilet.
Right. The idea is you're supposed to experience its intimacy, think about the questions it raises about value and function, but without actually, you know, validating its function.
Okay. So we've covered a lot. $5 trillion companies running compute-starved businesses for AGI dreams. Credit score wars fought on social media. Civil wars fueled by proxy drones. Universities cutting classics PhDs to pay off debt. A $10 million gold toilet you can't use. It's time to try and tie some threads together. What's the big recurring theme you see here?
I think the overwhelming theme, really, is this intense challenge of figuring out, establishing, and defending value in a world that's incredibly complex and constantly being disrupted. Everywhere you look, the basic metrics we rely on, economic, political, cultural, they're either being fiercely questioned, deliberately changed, or outright manipulated.
You see that so clearly in finance, right? How do you actually value a tech company that's choosing a speculative, maybe decades away payoff like AGI over its current proven profitability? And how do you assess risk when the old bedrock of trust, the FICO score, is suddenly having its price jacked up tenfold and being weaponized in a corporate battle? It forces everyone to rethink how they measure reliability.
Exactly. And culturally, the very idea of authenticity, of value based on truth, it feels like it's under siege. In politics, you've got a candidate attacked by a racist deepfake that costs less than $5,000 to make. That forces everyone to doubt the authenticity of everything they see and hear. Meanwhile, in academia, these elite universities are forced to decide if the perceived value of endless expansion and prestige is worth gutting core knowledge-creating departments like classics. What's truly valuable there?
Maybe the best lesson on sorting out value comes from that little anecdote we found. The tech reporter who tried using ChatGPT as her coach for the New York Marathon.
Oh yeah, Isabel Bousquet. She got totally hooked on the AI's input. Trying to reduce running, peak performance down to just a calculation, sleep, food, muscle data, pacing. ChatGPT built her this super rigorous custom plan, and it worked. Technically, she was running faster than ever.
But then what happened?
As the race got closer, she started panicking, second-guessing the AI's advice, felt completely burned out. She was so focused on calculating the perfect race that she'd lost touch with the actual act of running. It wasn't until she talked to a human coach, Steve Mura, from the New York Roadrunners, that things clicked.
And what did the human coach tell her?
Something totally counterintuitive to her AI-driven mindset. He said, basically, running is the simplest sport we have. We need to remember what running is, and it's just running. Running is art as much as science. She realized she just needed to stop overthinking, stop calculating every single variable the AI could track.
And the amazing thing is ChatGPT had actually told her something similar earlier, right? Something like, don't overcomplicate it. The body knows what to do.
Exactly. But hearing it from the cold calculation of the AI, it didn't land. It meant nothing. Hearing essentially the same advice, but from an experienced human coach she trusted, that resonated. That was everything. The value wasn't just in the information itself, but in the trust, the context, the human connection behind it.
That feels key. AI can crunch the numbers, run the simulations, give you the data points. It can tell you why NVIDIA is worth $5 trillion based on projections.
Mm-hmm.
But it can't give you that critical judgment, that intuition, that gut feeling that comes from human experience. It can't tell you if the risk of chasing AGI is truly worth running your profitable core business in a compute-starved state. That requires a different kind of valuation.
That's really the takeaway, isn't it? In a world where big tech giants are willing to run their core businesses compute-starved for a speculative AGI future, where basic trust metrics like credit scores are being turned into weapons in corporate fights, how do you, the listener, weigh the immediate known costs of today against those potential but deeply unknown returns of tomorrow?
Yeah, what metric of value are you relying on in your own life, your work, your investments that might just be quietly changed or manipulated or rendered obsolete next week?
That's the kind of critical thinking, that examination of underlying value, we hope this deep dive prompts. Thanks for joining us.
Always fascinating. We hope this gives you some things to chew on as you navigate this very complex and disruptive world we're in.